and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm Ayan Deng Bior in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Monday, May 14th, 2018. The head of JMEC says the security and political situation remains unchanged in South Sudan.
The status quo is not inclusive and cannot bring sustainable peace.
And more deadly fighting in Raja over the weekend.
The first attempt was made at 8:30 in the morning. They were repulsed. They went and reorganized. They made another attempt at around 12:30 to 1. That was a major offensive.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The head of the Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMEC, adjourned a JMEC meeting shortly after it began today due to a lack of quorum. Some participants are already in Addis Ababa preparing for the third round of the High-Level Revitalization Forum, which is supposed to get underway on Thursday. Festus Mahai says the transitional government of national unity can no longer restore peace and stability across the country. Waki Simon Mudu reports for VOA from Juba.
Mahai says the current transitional government of national unity needs to be rescued if peace is to be restored in South Sudan.
The status quo is not inclusive and cannot bring sustainable peace.
Despite a cessation of hostilities agreement signed by the major warring parties last December, Mahai says the situation for civilians across the country has not improved and serious violations of the ceasefire continue unabated. 4.2 million people remain displaced, 2.4 million of whom fled to neighboring countries, and 7 million South Sudanese need assistance. Mahai adds government and rebel forces continue to obstruct humanitarian agencies from accessing areas and people in need of assistance.
The political and security situation remains uncertain. The humanitarian and economic situation remains dire. We risk further deterioration if urgent steps are not taken to end the conflict immediately. The country must embark on an inclusive peace process, as there can be no military solution to this conflict.
After abruptly adjourning today's JMEC meeting, Mahai called on all authorities in Juba and the opposition to accommodate each other's ideas to end what he calls a senseless war.
All our efforts, focus and energies, therefore, should be dedicated to the successful conclusion of the revitalization process and to ensure a return to full and inclusive implementation of the agreement.
Last week, international stakeholders to the peace process, including the U.S., U.K. and Norway, released statements telling South Sudan's leaders the transitional government is no longer inclusive, with the U.S. condemning any unilateral effort of the government of South Sudan to extend its power through some elections, legislature or the continued military offensives. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Residents and military sources say dozens of government and rebel fighters died during fighting in the Dolo area, 10 miles outside of the Lowell State capital, Raja, last weekend. A South Sudan Army spokesman accuses rebels loyal to General Paul Malong and Riek Machar of staging the attacks. Nabil Biagio has this report for VOA from Juba.
SPLA spokesperson Brigadier General Lulroy Kwang says rebels loyal to the former army chief Paul Malong have been carrying attacks on government positions on the border with Sudan since last week.
They joined forces with the rebels loyal to Riek Machar under direct command of Yakum. Then they came and attacked Baloku, 8 kilometers southwest of Raja. The first attempt was made at 8:30 in the morning. They were repulsed. They went and reorganized. They made another attempt at around 12:30 to 1. That was a major offensive. It lasted for about 1 hour. They were also repulsed, pursued, and as a result, we succeeded in overrunning their operational base at Dolo.
Kwong says SPLA forces killed dozens of rebels, including the rebel commander, and confiscated their ammunition.
As of this morning, when I got in touch with our command, the rebels had reported having lost a total of 47 fighters. That number included the brigadier. It turned out to be Ramdan Khuda Ramdan, the commander for Western Command for the rebels.
Kwong says it seems that forces loyal to the two rebel leaders have decided to work together against government forces.
It is for the first time that we are witnessing joint operations being launched against SPLA by forces loyal to Malong Ariak. And for the first time, it has become crystal clear that Malong has chosen military option, as indicated by attacks on our defensive positions.
SPLA and opposition military spokesperson Colonel Lampol Gabriel confirms the killing of a rebel commander in Dolo, but says the rebel forces were on the defensive.
The regime forces attacked probably on around the weekend, killing our base commander, the rank of the brigadier, and injuring some few individuals. But we managed to repel them after 4 hours of fight.
Gabriel claims that the rebels killed 28 SPLA soldiers and denies forces loyal to Malong fought side by side with forces loyal to Riek Machar. He says SPLA IO forces fought in self-defense.
It's always the government attacking. We are not in the position of attacking. We are under strict orders, made very clear to us, you guys maintain your defensive position.
South Sudan in Focus placed several calls to residents in Raja to clarify who started the fighting. But phone lines did not go through due to poor connections. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biaju in Juba.
Police in Juba say they are interrogating three suspects in conjunction with the killing of two pastors yesterday morning in Juba's Gudele neighborhood. A South Sudan National Police spokesman says the two pastors were killed by armed robbers. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the details for VOA from Juba.
Eyewitnesses in Block 5 in the Gudele neighborhood say they are shocked by the brutal killing of their pastor Sunday morning. Pastor Martin Apollo from the Gudele-based House of God for Holy Nations Church says the armed men went to the house of Pastor Matthew Ogwok early Sunday and shot his wife, who is also a pastor in the church.
When the criminal came to the house, they knocked the door and they said, "Open the door." So Pastor opened the door for them and ordered him to give what he had. Then he said, "No, I don't have anything. You know, see, even the situation of my house, I have nothing to in my hand." Then they collect all the mobile, and they begin to check all around the house. After checking, and they did not get anything, so they took the wife outside and locked the pastor inside. When they took the wife of the pastor out, they try to rape the woman, and the wife refused. And they begin to wrestle with her. And then they shot the woman. The husband was locked inside, you know. Good enough that the windows are not thicked. Just covered with some piece of clothes. The pastor escaped from the window with a small child of 2 years old. So then he ran and began to cry for rescue. But you know, as you know, security is sometimes very hard for you to come out at night to see what's happening in your neighbor. No one came out in that moment.
Apollo says Pastor Ogwok ran to the house of Pastor Johnson Malueth. He says the two were returning to Pastor Ogwok's house when they were met by armed men in police uniform who claimed they were patrolling the area. They agreed to allow the armed men to escort them to Pastor Ogwok's house. Apollo says upon reaching Ogwok's house, the armed men turned their guns on the two pastors, killing Pastor Malueth and wounding Pastor Ogwok.
Actually, we don't know if this is the police, the government police, or the same criminal. This is what we don't know, because this is the incident, the second incident happened, resulting to the death of that father and the injury of other father, the one of the wife who was shot.
A neighbor who identified herself only as Joyce for fear of reprisal says Gudele has been secure for the past 4 months. Speaking in Arabic, she says after yesterday's incident, many residents now live in fear.
I work in Abuna Tarade.
When the pastor came out, we were inside the fence, but we heard the gunshot, which probably killed the pastor's wife. When the pastor returned, he found his wife dead, and we heard him crying, "People, my wife is dead, my wife is dead." We then got out and started crying together with him.
Police spokesperson Brigadier Daniel Justin Achor says police arrested three suspects.
Yesterday, through investigation, we managed to arrest some people, but still the investigation is going on. Well, we have three so far, but still the list is big. I mean, it's long, but still, maybe because people are involved the whole night yesterday, even up to this morning, still we are getting information here and there. So we're still leaving that for the investigation to take their time, and then we come out with something ready at hand.
Pastor Apollo called the two deceased pastors great community leaders.
For me, it was really a great loss to South Sudan in general. Especially me yesterday when I went to the hospital, I never cried one day in one of my family members who died in the family. But yesterday, I was collapsed. And I was collapsed, total collapse.
Last year, the South Sudan National Police Service set up police post in Pudele following reports of several night robberies and killing in the area. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Rebel leader Paul Malong says he is not afraid of any probe into his tenure as the former head of the South Sudan Army. General Malong admits that he was in charge when fighting erupted in the capital in July 2016. But Malong claims he was executing orders from President Salva Kiir during fighting between Riek Machar forces and President Kiir's bodyguards. The former head of the army says he is ready to testify before any court wanting to hold leaders accountable who committed atrocities during the fighting in Juba. My colleague John Tanza reports.
I'm a South Sudanese. If I committed anything against that, the accusation came from where I should be accounted to, I would have been accounted.
You're telling me that you are not responsible for the atrocities committed during your time in office. Is that what you're telling me?
Exactly. You see, what was happening on the way, people were killed and they are cut to pieces. That was not the SPLA. There were so many forces in the bush who are doing that. When those were killed and cut to pieces, and they are from different tribes. Where they blame me that I'm the one doing that?
Why should the people of South Sudan trust General Paul Malong and his South Sudan United Front, given the track record of the army under your command? The army did a lot of terrible things. The human rights reported them. The international community even put pressure on the government of South Sudan because of the army under your command. Yeah. So why should people trust you now?
John, let me tell you, people are supporting me because I'm related to them. And in my being, I'm with the people during the struggle, and I'm peaceful to everybody. The people know me, believe me. Today, the people of South Sudan see that I'm salvation to their problem.
You're saying that the people of South Sudan are looking at you like their savior. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, and I will do that.
In which sense? How are you going to save the people of South Sudan when the army under you were going door to door, killing people on ethnic lines? How are you going to save the people of South Sudan?
That one is really fake news. That everyone fake news. I have told you before. I was in charge of the fight of 2016.
You gave orders for your troops to attack the house of Riek Machar from the air and on the ground, and your troops pursued Riek Machar for 37 days up to the border with DRC.
Okay. Riek was fighting, and there was nothing left. If somebody is fighting you, what will you do? Riek was fighting. He was having more than 15,000, and he did not come to Juba with 15,000 troops. The forces were allowed to come with him. They were less than 1,000. He was fighting after people fight with him, and he was dislodged under Jebel Kujur, where he had started fighting, and he was destroyed. I went to the commander-in-chief and I told him that you declare ceasefire. President by then have declared ceasefire. Machar continuing to clear Cherry Street where he was, just to receive the equipment and to receive the ammunition in that place.
Let's change gears a little bit here. Some of your colleagues in the army, people like General Elias Wainyipoch, who spoke to us, said bad things about your record in the army. When Tenyue Katenge said you went to the Bank of South Sudan and took $5 million at night, General Elias Wai said he worked with you and he knows that you are corrupt.
I took $5 million for what now? The $5 million are not ammunition. Why did I take them to go and do what?
That's what Atenge said. Atenge said you went to the bank at night. You took $5 million and the money was meant to kill Machar.
Look here, John. I think the government was there. The president and the commandership was there. If I went to the bank by gunpoint to go and take money, why I should not be arrested?
General Paul Malong, it's not easy to arrest you when you have all the bodyguards and armored vehicles and RPG and PKMs around you. It's not easy to arrest somebody like that.
Okay. Who? It's not you. I'm not asking you to arrest me. I'm not asking who have said that to arrest me. The commandership is there. Who is the superior commander that he can order the whole army for somebody who went to the bank at night to arrest him? And what do you think that I'm going to do with the $5 million? For what?
That's former Army Chief of Staff Paul Malong speaking to John Tanza. You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. A death penalty sentence in Sudan sparks global outrage. More on that when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how can African countries develop to export more manufacturing goods rather than raw materials?
African countries should open many companies, industries, markets, new markets that will specialize in manufacturing. So as they manufacture, they will have to export more.
African countries should put up more industries and encourage people to go into agro-processing.
And also needs people to be trained on how to manufacture the things ready so that they can be transported.
I will have to say that we need to build our own machines. A product like cocoa, for example, if we had the machineries to manufacture chocolates, I'm sure we will not be exporting it outside.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
Say the name!
Noor Hussein!
Say the name!
Noor Hussein!
Say the name!
Noor Hussein!
Over a dozen protesters met outside the U.S. Capitol on Saturday, demanding justice for Noor Hussein Hamad. Hamad is a 19-year-old Sudanese woman who was recently sentenced to death in Sudan for killing her husband, but she says it was in self-defense. Her case has sparked global outrage and brought together activists here in the Washington area over the weekend. Amnesty International reported last week that Hamad's husband was trying to rape her. Amnesty is calling for the abolition of the death penalty in Sudan, an end to forced marriages and child marriages, and urging Sudanese lawmakers to enact laws that protect victims of marital rape. Wafai May Alamin is a humanitarian activist and one of the organizers of Saturday's rally.
Noora was, at the age of 16, she was married off without her consent, and she escaped to live with her aunt for 3 years. 3 years later, that was in 2017, she was told that she could come back, the wedding was off, and when she returned, that was not the scenario that she walked into, and she was given away to her husband. And for the first 4 days, she had refused him, and he attempted to consummate the marriage and was able to do that by recruiting a relative to help. So after that, the next day he attempted again, and she stabbed him multiple times, and he was killed, he died. So then she went home to her parents, and she was immediately, turned away to the police just for, killing someone, just kind of for that reason. So the time span, this all happened in 2017, and it's just now getting the attention. And people are wondering, why is this just now happening? Why is no one hearing about it? And that's mainly because the legal process in itself takes a really long time to generate interviews, get facts correct. And on April 29th was when the verbal verdict was announced that she was found guilty and convicted of premeditated murder, punishment for which is death by hanging in Sudan. And on May 10th was the official sentencing hearing where the family of the deceased, so May 10th, she was officially sentenced to be to death. So the defense is already moving towards making an appeal. So we do have the defense preparing an appeal, and my team right now is working directly with them on the ground to be able to, we just want to provide the world with the most accurate facts and just be ready to prepare the defense with whatever they need on our end internationally. So it just started as a social media campaign to raise awareness about it globally, raise awareness about the idea of forgiveness and humanity. And we want to move this message in a direction that is more accepting to, the ways of the world. We may not understand what's happening, why people do certain things, why cultures and traditions are the way that they are, but in the process, we can't ignore that. So we just want to make sure that we're as diplomatic as possible, we're as just as possible to all parties involved. We're just trying to encourage and promote dialogue, even if it's with someone who's opposing, has different views than you. Just use it an opportunity to educate yourself, educate people, get an understanding for why people think the way they think. And through the process of gaining humanitarian change, we can't dehumanize people in the process. That's really just what we're pushing for. We want to be as readily available for whatever the defense team needs in preparing the appeal.
The social media campaign that you just mentioned has been effective. And in fact, the response to the campaign has been global, including the rally this weekend here in Washington. What do you hope will happen as a result of the awareness that you are helping to create?
I think our hope in the campaign is just, to continue to educate people, to continue to promote and encourage those kinds of dialogues amongst, your peers, family, friends, power players who can help on large entities.
Is Nora's story unique?
Nora's story is not unique. I would say the only thing that's very unique about it is the caliber to which it is reaching the world, the caliber to which it is educating people and pushing people past limits to. I know directly in Sudan right now there is talk about people who are want to address their trauma and their mental health, and that's something that's never really been discussed on that level within the nation. So it's bringing about a lot of awareness to a lot of different things that we didn't know. So it's not unique. It happens all over the world.
That was Wafa May Alamin, a humanitarian activist speaking to me earlier today from Richmond, Virginia. Technical talks among Egypt, Sudan, and Ethiopia over a disputed dam that Ethiopia is building on the Nile River have stalled. Egypt and Ethiopia are at odds over the construction of the Grand Renaissance Dam, a hydroelectric project that Cairo fears will reduce the water that runs to its fields via Sudan. Addis Ababa hopes the dam will make Ethiopia a hub for the electricity-hungry region and denies it will undermine Egypt's water resources. Rawai Tawfiq is an associate professor of political science at Cairo University. She explained to VOA's Mohamed Al-Shinawi why the two countries were not able to reach a compromise.
I think the problem is that looking at Egypt and Ethiopia, they're sticking to the main positions. So there is no change if we follow the 17 rounds of negotiations. There is little progress because each party is actually sticking to its position. So for Ethiopia, for instance, its main point is rejecting historical agreements and thus deciding not to acknowledge Egypt's current share of the Nile water, historical share of the Nile water. For Egypt is sticking to the fact that it's historical rights and acquired rights in the Nile Basin has to be respected, which is not at all accepted by Ethiopia, because Ethiopia is claiming that it was not party of any agreement in the past and is not committed to accepting this share.
So what kind of options do Egypt have to deal with water security challenge perceived as a result of the Ethiopian dam?
Egypt has already taken some measures in order to increase the efficiency of water use. Egypt is already recycling water in order to bridge the gap between supply and demand. And according to the new Egyptian water policy, there is, you know, more and more in that direction, in increasing the efficiency of using water in agriculture in particular, because agriculture is consuming more than 80% of Egypt's water quota, and also for domestic use. So imposing penalties, for instance, on the excessive use of water for domestic purposes is something that is totally new, and it's meant to introduce a new culture of increasing water efficiency at the domestic level.
Could a drastic change in water flowing from the Nile to Egypt introduce an Egyptian military action?
No, I think this is very unlikely. Egypt has invested in promoting its relations with all African countries in the last 4 or 5 years, and all Egyptian officials, even at times of crisis in the negotiations, have confirmed that the military option is not actually on the table. But at the same time, we should not rule out the fact that this is actually a major source of tensions in the region through proxy wars and interventions and so on. So there has to be an interest from all powers to mediate in solving this problem.
Ethiopia argues that Egypt's share of water will not be decreased by the dam, but the filling of the dam is the real problem. Is that the case?
Ethiopia is saying that, well, there will not be significant harm to Egypt and Sudan, but the problem is, what does the significant harm mean? Ethiopia does not actually acknowledge this share of either Egypt or Sudan, because it was not part of the 1959 agreement. So, and Ethiopia is very reluctant to sign any agreement that will actually commit it not to reduce water flow to Egypt. So I think it's more like a diplomatic rhetoric that Ethiopia is trying to use in order to attract international regional support to its dam project, rather than a real commitment that Ethiopia is ready to respect.
That was Rawai Tawfiq, an associate professor of political science at Cairo University. She was speaking with our colleague Mohamed El-Shanawi. And that's our show for this Monday. We leave you with the song Get Up, Stand Up by Bob Marley.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. Is that all that Peter scrolled after story had never been told? So now you see the light, hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, don't give up the fight.
Take away everything and make everybody feel high. But if you know what life is worth, you would look for yours unheard.
We've been listening to Bob Marley with the song Get Up, Stand Up. I'm Ayan Deng Buer in Washington. Thanks for listening. Let us know what you think about the show. You can find us on the web at SouthSudan@voanews.com or reach us on Facebook. Our title is South Sudan in Focus. We hope to see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Lord, get up, keep us traveling on. Don't give up the fight.
Yeah. We're sick and tired of your isms, kisms.